The Next CMO podcast explores topics that are on the minds of forward-thinking marketing executives, from leadership and strategy to emerging technologies. And we bring these topics to life by interviewing leading experts in their fields. The Next CMO is sponsored by Plana, makers of the world's first AI-based marketing leadership platform, and hosted by me, Peter Mahoney, the founder and CEO of Plana, along with my co-host, Kelsey Kraft. In this episode, we speak to Jay Kulkarni, the founder and CEO of Theorem, an innovative digital marketing services company. Jay has over 20 years of experience in digital advertising and was one of the earliest employees at ad network pioneer DoubleClick. We discuss strategies to deal with ad targeting with the increasing restrictions on third-party cookies, how owners of the walled garden networks will become even more powerful, and how flexibility in marketing will be one of the keys to survival in an increasingly competitive world. I hope you enjoy the show.
Thanks so much for joining us on the Next CMO podcast, Jay. Super excited to have you on the show. Would love to learn a little bit more about you and what you do for Theorem.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here. Thank you, Kelsey. Thank you, Peter. So Theorem operates at the intersection of media, technology, and marketing, where that's the space we play in. And started Theorem about 18 years ago after I quit DoubleClick in the recession of 2002. And I said, this new industry, digital marketing, needs a specialized player. And that's how the journey began.
Great. So interestingly, we have a little bit of a shared past. I was in the ad tech space back around then, Jay. I worked for a company called Engage, which was part of the CMGI family of companies. So tell me a little bit about your DoubleClick days. I'm gonna get all nostalgic for all that.
We both are. And it brings back memories, blast from the past. Engage, CMGI. Yes, I remember them well. One of my roles, I was a very early employee at DoubleClick, probably employee 40 or something. And one of the jobs I did was to build products. And we used to go head to head up against Engage because around the same time we were launching products for advertisers and publishers, Engage was doing the same. NetGravity was doing the same in the good old days. So these are some of the names from the good old days of the dot-com boom, so to speak.
That's great. It's funny. Kelsey has no idea what we're talking about, probably. We don't want to know what she was doing 20 years ago. But it's really interesting because what we were doing back then is de rigueur for what happens today. It's boring. It was so cutting edge back then. I remember I was actually in charge of product marketing for Engage back in 1998, 1999, something like that. And I remember launching AudienceNet, which was the first behavioral-based profiling network that, spoiler alert, didn't really work that well, by the way. And the big problem was the lack of data. And the big promise for advertising back then was that you should be able to target people based on their clickstream behavior. So what are they doing? What are they exploring around the web? What are they seeing, et cetera? And this is in the very early days where people were trying to figure out privacy for the first time. But even tracking that data and storing that data was extremely expensive. So it was very difficult to do. And there wasn't nearly as much data as you needed to do targeting. But of course, today, you know, you have people like Kelsey who grew up doing digital marketing, and you just expect that there's almost limitless data available about everybody.
Yeah, you know, they say the more things change, the more they remain the same. In those days, cookies were controversial, and they're back in fashion again today for all the wrong reasons, so to speak. So you're right. We are collecting data in vast quantities, but on the flip side of it, there is a growing, I guess, awareness of privacy rights at the individual level. So it's going to be interesting what transpired. You know, 15 years ago, there were some privacy advocates, but nothing compared to what we are seeing today, where it is being voiced by individuals who are impacted.
Yeah, and what do you see happening over the next over the next period of time here as we adapt to the cookie-less or less cookie-full environment that we're dealing with the deployment of the new iOS release that makes it harder for people to track across sites, things like that. So one, can you explain that to our listeners, what we're dealing with now, and how do you think it's going to impact marketers going forward?
Right. So one of the primary, three major points, one of the primary reasons third-party cookie became so influential was the ability to retarget when people were not on your website. That's the gist of why it became so prominent and the gist of why most of the ad tech technologies are based on third-party targeting and third-party cookies. When that goes away, ironically, it was the publishers who lamented that a lot of the third-party cookies had more data on their users. So now the second point is maybe there is a reemergence of the power of the first-party cookie, where individual site owners, content owners are able to better control their visitors, albeit on a smaller scale, and that will potentially impact business models. The third one is I don't think the walled gardens are going to be impacted as much because they have the ultimate first-party identifier, i.e. email login. So anytime I log into my Apple devices, anytime I log into Google, so they already have that first-party sign on. And the other publishers will have to find ways to enhance how they enrich their first-party data. So the first-party data will... first-party cookie will gain prominence, and the ability for the owners of that first-party data will have a leg up. But the walled gardens will continue because of the size and scale to still have that influence. So those are the three trends.
And just explain for our listeners who may not be as familiar with cookie tracking, the difference between cookies, et cetera, so that we're all talking the same thing.
Technically, when you go to a website, let's say I go to planner.com, that browser, because I'm on planner.com, sets the first-party cookie. So I'm being tracked on your website, you own it. On the third-party cookie, if you're looking to monetize your pages, you will embed a tag that serves an ad from a third party. So that's where the third-party name comes in. So the third party has a different domain. And anytime I visit another website which has tags from that third party, they recognize me as going cross websites so they can retarget. So the retargeting will definitely be impacted. The DMPs will struggle because they're using the cookies to follow people around the web universe. Whereas because the first party cookie is managed, set and controlled by Planner, you know that Jay, when I visit, obviously you don't know it's Jay, it's just a random number, but you're able to enrich that. So that's fundamentally your first party, which is the domain in which it is set, and the third party is another third party setting that cookie.
Great, very helpful. And one thing that we should do, this is probably a good tee up, Jay, to talk about sort of the future of what you think of as the flexible future of marketing. So tell us about how we're going to see this transition of marketing happening.
Right. So a couple of major trends here where everything around us is becoming flexible. So just the way we work, just the way we go to meetings, everything has changed and evolved, and probably the pandemic has accelerated it. So it's just not the flexible future of marketing, so to speak, but the overall way we live and engage is changing, and it's flexible. In some ways, it is Darwinian, because that's the evolution. What's the first thing they say in Darwinian? That it's not the biggest, the fastest, the smartest that will survive. It is the one that adapts most. So in some ways, we are experiencing that rapid change in the ability to adapt to changing environments, not just marketing, not just business, but even in our day-to-day way we interact and live our lives is changing rapidly. So that's overarching. So if your whole macro ecosystem is undergoing the seismic shift, then it goes to vouch that, yes, even the tasks you do, i.e. marketing, since we're in that industry, needs to be flexible to that. So that's where I think the macro trend is influencing the flexible future of marketing. Coming down to one level down, the profusion of all these platforms that are cropping up to engage, retain, and interact with audiences. So you have this profusion. So what does a brand do? If a brand has to grow, retain audiences, attract new audiences, there's only so many things they can master. So whether you're an in-house agency within a brand or you're tapping into it, you need to be very comfortable about what are the things you want to build and bake into your DNA, whether it is data, whether it's your brand strategy, whether it's like you need to have your core DNA. And for everything else, you'll need to rely on experts. And that's the flexibility, the ability to tap into on a as needed basis, experts, whether it's marketing, whether it's visible media, whether it's media, you need the ability to know what is it that you keep in-house, make it part of your DNA, and how do you tap into other experts? And that's where the flexibility comes in.
It's really interesting to think about what are those core things that you think you need to own? Because obviously, marketing and a lot of businesses gotten much more complex these days, but marketing in particular has become much more sophisticated than it's ever been. And virtually everybody outsources something. And there's, of course, a sliding scale. In fact, I was speaking to someone who's a software company that services the Shopify universe. And he was talking about how heavily outsourced most Shopify-driven companies are, where they outsource virtually everything. So they're fairly large brands that have a relatively tiny set of internal staffs. But it makes you really wonder, and you mentioned some things like data as an example, but how do you decide what are those few things that you need to own directly inside the walls of your company?
It depends on which line of business you are in. So if you are a D2C brand, your need would be audience acquisition, getting in front of the right audiences at scale. To do that, you'll probably need to have data and creative skills in-house to manage your brand story and have some kind of a discipline around that. If you are a content owner or a content publisher, like a publisher, then the content creation piece is your DNA. That needs to be within the, you know, within your teams. So again, it goes back to what is the core element of your business and what is it that you absolutely need to do to keep in-house that core competitive edge and what defines you. I'll give you a couple of those examples. The third wildcard that has cropped up is the competition for good talent. So you have that. It's a gig economy. It's hard to get people with the skills. So that adds another layer of complexity. So if you have a set of subject matter experts that you want to keep in-house, how readily accessible is that talent for you? And can you retain it? Because if talent is coming in and moving out, then it becomes very hard to retain that institutional knowledge. So it's the combination of what is your brand or business DNA and what are the skills you need to manage that and own that. Everything else outside of that, I wouldn't call it extraneous, but it potentially comes in waves. If you're implementing a new platform, all platforms need design, architecture, implementation. So that you can potentially bring people in on a as-needed basis. The third, the next piece in marketing would be ongoing campaigns, right? How do you keep attracting new audiences and getting new audiences? Now, that could be a hybrid where your in-house teams can manage the design of the campaign, whereas execution can be based on your seasonality of your business and access to talent and skills. You can work with outside partners.
Well, I'll tell you go ahead, Kelsey. I'm dominating the conversation already. I'm getting too excited. Go ahead.
No worries. So I guess this is a good segue then to talk about, you know, Therum's core DNA. What does that look like? And how have you guys evolved and adapted based on what's been going on in the world today to really prepare for, you know, the future and continue to stay ahead of other marketing companies?
Like I mentioned early on, Therum operates at the intersection of media, technology, and marketing. So those are the three core skill sets we bring to our client base. And our expertise and remit, we're not in the media planning. We help execute media plans and buys after they're done. So we don't actually buy and sell the media. So our core is you take that media plan and you put it into action. So across media, technology, and marketing, we are experts across a variety of different technologies and platforms. For example, we work with multiple marketing cloud platforms. We are a certified Salesforce partner. We touch all of the programmatic ad tech stack. We work with creative. And in terms of technology and skill sets, we have deep chops in automation and data. So if you step back and think of it, these are all the building blocks our clients, our brands, whether you're a publisher or a brand direct, D2C, need to scale your marketing business and operations. So if you go back to my earlier comment, a lot of our clients try to keep that brand strategy and the brand DNA in-house. But when it comes to scaling out campaigns across marketing cloud, biddable media, looking at automation to scale things further, they turn to experts like Therum.
I'm a big believer that the element that you mentioned a minute ago, Jay, that you help them do, you help them execute the plan. But the thing that the brand needs to own internally is the plan. They really need to build, own, and optimize the overall plan. Now, there are elements of it that you may farm out to partners to execute. But what your partners often miss is they often miss the forest for the trees. They may be executing a small piece of a much broader strategy without really understanding how all the pieces fit together, as an example. And they may make decisions or recommendations based on not really knowing how all of this stuff is supposed to fit together into a coherent plan. So that seems to be the area. And interestingly, you know, it's one of the reasons I got so excited about building my company is that there seemed to be this lack of platform to tie the whole plan together, because it's the tech stack for marketing plans on most companies is the Microsoft Office suite, which is a little shocking after all these years. But yeah, that owning that piece is really important, I think.
Yeah, to you mentioned the word knitting all these pieces together is in itself a massive undertaking. Now, not only is knitting all these different platforms together complex, as the brand story evolves, new platforms need to be incorporated or you need to transition out of it. So it's a constant evolution, because if you look at the landscape 5-7 years ago, you know, it was very different from where it is today. And if you look at how the pandemic may affect how people consume content, streaming audio, video, shopping online, again, that continues to change. So the ability for us to be experts across all these different ecosystems, marketing cloud, programmatic, biddable media, and process automation allows us to be very synergistic with our clients where they focus on their brand and the media planning, buying, and their strategy. And when it comes to the technology piece and the execution, we step in to make it real.
So you have this great perspective over lots of different plans from lots of different brands that you help implement. Are there any sort of key insights that you can pull out of what have you seen change over the last year about either the approaches that people have employed or the things that just seem to be working better or worse from before? What's really changed in the last year besides everything? I realize the whole world has changed in the last year.
So access to platforms and technology has become easier. It may not be affordable, but you can access it. So the first instinct of teams is, I want to do it all by myself. I can do it all together. So there's that impulse to try new things because it is, you know, exciting, it's technology, and it's accessible. Previously, technologies are not that accessible, so you were limited in what you could do. The downside of having too much access, you want to do it all in-house, and going back to my earlier comment about what do you focus on, what do you keep internal, do you have the talent and the teams to manage it all together, that has started to become a lot more unfocused in addition to all the issues we had last year. A combination of access, people wanting to do a lot themselves very quickly, and lack of trained resources is making some of the execution a lot more complex than it needs to be. What will potentially happen is as budgets get, you know, tightened, people will start to realize that just because you have access to technologies and all these different platforms, we may not be adequately equipped to do it all in-house. Which, to your Shopify example, most of the Shopify brands are D2C. And the reason they outsource it or they use a partner ecosystem is they are fundamentally limited by what they can do in-house. Secondly, as D2C brands evolve, I'm using that as an example, very rapidly they need to experiment with new platforms. So in the early days, they focus on social media channels, Instagram, Snap, just to get traction. But once you get traction, the ability to replicate revenue at scale, you need new platforms. So there needs to be a little more debate about how quickly brands want to embrace platforms, what they keep in-house, and how to map it to where they are in their evolution.
So give us an example of some of the platforms that brands are trying to implement and struggling with.
Right. Sticking with the D2C example, given the migration of shopping and all the activity online, it's actually quite easy to get going with the storefront, i.e. let's say Shopify or whatever else, get that storefront going. The supply chain could be an issue, but let's table that. That doesn't involve the marketing piece of it. So you get a storefront, you have a niche product, very focused, targeting the millennials. You go into social channels, which are, again, easy to access. They have a very low threshold for spend. So you get that initial trend going. So you start to book revenue. But the beauty of the D2C brand was very low barriers to entry. But that in itself, after a while, becomes tricky. But not because now to expand your audience, you need to go into new channels. Those channels could be programmatic or other biddable medias. Now you need to be masters of these different channels that are very different from what you started off with. This is where things start to get a little more complicated. Biddable media programmatic is potentially good for acquisition to get new eyeballs. But what happens after you accumulated a good set of customers? How do you re-engage with them? How do you retarget to them? How do you send them rewards and offers in a very personalized, meaningful way? That's where other platforms like Marketing Cloud comes in, which are very good for retargeting and having that ongoing communication. So you start with a niche social channel to get going. Then you diversify into biddable media. But then if you want to, once you have a client base, you have a list, you have your email addresses, you know their behaviors, you have a relationship, how do you bring them back into your fold on a regular basis? So that's the transition. And that's what we're seeing in the marketplace today.
Yeah, really, really fascinating. I know that there's a, like you said, there's a low barrier to entry for engaging some of these, certainly some of these channels. But as you start to combine it into a broader strategy and make sure it all makes sense, it becomes harder and harder for people to do. So what do you think, if you look at the brands that get this the most that we might all recognize, who comes to mind when you think, hey, these brands really get this omni-channel, really engaged marketing strategy better than most?
No one brand springs to mind, but most of the digital native D2C brands have done it. The very extreme example could be a Tesla, because the only way to buy a car is from their website. You can go and test drive it, but they started this like 10 years ago, where a very ultra high-end, high-ticket item is your ultimate. That's what they do. But then you have some of the insurgent brands like Casper. They start off mattress. Now they are into the sleep, all of it, you know, the whole sleep experience, if you will. They come to mind. Allbirds comes to mind. And one of the things that jumps, there's another common denominator. Not only are they native, digital native first, but they're also purpose-driven. I use Tesla as an extreme example. But if you go downstream, sleeping, wellness. So a lot of these D2C brands have the technology chops, but they have very, very strong purpose in their DNA. And that's, again, something they keep in-house. They may go elsewhere to scale their marketing operations, but you can't outsource purpose. You have it or you don't. And I think the ability of the brand who has a very strong purpose at the core, that drives how they engage with their customers because they have a very strong North Star.
And how would you recommend that a non-digital native brand, how do you think they should be adapting to learn from more of the digital natives out there?
Baby steps, because the mistakes can be very expensive. So if you are already a brand, let's say you're not digital native or not digital native the way the other brands are, but you already have a legacy. You have clients, you have behavior, you have the data about your customer base. You know your product. So in the zeal to transition to becoming digital native, it's very, there's a danger that they could lose that purpose. Their purpose was whatever it was offline. So when you transition to becoming more aggressively digital native, they can't lose that purpose, whatever it is. And then break down the client base that they want to keep and engage, and then figure out where does that audience reside? Where are they hanging out online? And then work backwards. Who's your audience? Where are they located? What is it that they enjoy? Based on their interest in demographics, they may be in different places. And then what's the best way to get your message or re-engage with them where they are? And then figure out the technology. In fact, even within Theorem, the last thing we look at is technology. We start with what's the objective? Who are you trying to reach? What does that experience look like? And then go find the technology, the platform that gets you to that objective.
So what do you think about some of the more narrow cast communities out there that you might try to engage in for customers? So we're in one now, right? I mean, podcast is a medium that is rich because of the depth that you have time to, and so you have the ability to get into more depth than you otherwise would. Obviously, we're getting to learn a little bit about you. We get to learn a bit about Theorem. We get to learn about how to be a contemporary digital marketer, all those things. You know, but, and then there are other emerging channels like the audio first channels out there, the, you know, the Clubhouses of the world and things like that. How should brands think about these small niche channels, and do they play a part in their overall digital strategy at all?
Absolutely. The one area where narrow casting comes to mind is medicine, or finding patients who have rare diseases or rare conditions where your broadcasting doesn't work. So the ability to source who could benefit from, whether it's therapeutics, whether it's wellness, whether it's medicine, whether it's drugs, lends by its very nature to narrow casting, because they typically would congregate either in blogs or they listen to podcasts that carry a certain very specific niche information that would be hard to get in this very broadcast world. So narrow casting would be highly targeted, but you know exactly who you're trying to reach and then find them. And typically, if they're in a very narrow cast medium, then the way you communicate that message also is very well defined, i.e. podcast, it's an audio-only app. If it is video, then it is different. So the medium is already setting the stage for the kind of messaging experience that you have, that your end consumer who's already said what he or she is interested in by being in that. So it becomes a very efficient mode of communication as opposed to a broadcast where there's a lot of waste to it.
So one thing I've noticed about this conversation, Jay, is that from someone who has such a deep, long history in the technology side of things, it always seems to be last for you. I mean, we spent most of our time talking about the audience, the brand strategy, things like that. Is there a lesson there for others?
Going back to my last point, or whenever I made that point, technology is a tool. So I like to define what is the problem, figure out what is the value we can accomplish by solving that problem, and then go find the tool which leads to the budget and everything else to help accomplish that. I've been in situations where a lot of installations have failed because the tool was the first thing that was picked, and then you're trying to force fit everything around that tool. For a guy with a hammer, everything looks like a nail. So if we step back and say, what is the problem we're trying to fix, and lead with that, the value creation, the problem, the solution, then the tools are fairly easy, I think.
It all goes up to starting, you know, how to even build out your marketing plan, your campaigns. You've got to start with the goal. You've got to start with the messaging and the audience. It relates back in the same way. I want to switch gears a little bit here because I'm curious on, and I know we've talked a little bit on the B2C front. Obviously, the world is evolving. There's so much that we've learned and things that have changed. Now, some of these strategies that people place on the B2C front, you know, they have to have like a seasonal business. There's certain holidays that come up about, and there's certain approaches that companies need to take. What do those look like, and how do you think those are going to change in the future?
So I don't know if it's starting to co-mingle, where I don't know if it's going to be clear-cut B2B or B2C or B2B2C, because eventually you are going to that end user. So more and more companies are going to want to have a direct interaction with that end customer, whatever that might be. And it's becoming more feasible to do it because of access to those consumers, wherever they might be, understanding where they consume their content, where they hang out, whether in social circles, or whatever device they might be using. So the ability to go directly to your end consumer is more realistic. In terms of getting there, that's the challenge, which is, do we have the right tools in place? You mentioned seasonality. The biggest upheaval in the pandemic, or one of the biggest upheavals, was the retail and the e-commerce. So traditionally, most retailers got a big physical component to it. And the ability to, I still like to go and experience the physical spaces, but the economics of having physical and selling online just doesn't work out from a supply chain perspective. So that those two, I think, would be the drivers of the acceleration, like you mentioned, to the B2B to C migration, which is managing the seasonality, managing the spikes, and shedding those physical channels that are being held on for legacy reasons.
It's been interesting to see the retailers in particular adapt, and I think in a really creative ways, to during the pandemic. But then I think a lot of these things are going to just stay forever because it's a better shopping experience in some ways, to be able to blend the digital with the physical. And it's been done out of necessity for social distancing purposes. But there are actually some really interesting applications of being able to complete the commerce transaction in a much more interestingly blended digital way. For instance, being able to pre-shop for the things you want, but then maybe go to the store and try them on, or do curbside delivery, or whatever it is. It just creates a much more seamless consumer experience. So the bar seems to continue to go up. So how do brands stay up with that bar? Because I assume consumers are going to start to like some of these experiences and demand more and more of these really rich digital experiences when they're dealing with their brands.
Yeah. Some brands have done a good job at it. I think Uniqlo pre-pandemic had a massive store on Fifth Avenue, and they blended their digital and their in-store very well. Nike had their store there. So there are those extreme examples of those stores trying to take a shot at it. But I think it's going to be difficult for smaller retailers. That's where the bulk of the retail transactions take place. So I think it is the convenience factor, which we're already seeing in terms of delivery and curbside pickup, that would probably be, that would probably lend itself more to a digital adoption as opposed to an experience, which is typically more for a higher ticket item.
Makes a lot of sense. And what's your outlook? I mean, I'm sure you have lots of early discussions and plans in place as some of the brands and retailers are thinking toward, you know, the big holiday and back to school seasons and things like that. Are they feeling good about it? Are marketers feeling bullish about, you know, continued expansion in consumer purchasing, or are they still a little bit reluctant?
Our business has picked up. We typically going into Labor Day, September coming up, and then the end of year shopping goes on. Due to the pandemic, I think overall volumes online have picked up, and 100% of our business is digital. We don't do any traditional, we don't do print, nothing. So from our perspective, that has picked up. I'm not really sure if it is going to be a pointer to a continued trend beyond December, because not all schools are opening. Some are opening in pockets. Some are still, you know, offline, if you will. And there is always that, I don't know, the second wave or the third wave in some parts of the world. So you always have that reticence of going full blown into a holiday season. So that would be the unknown in terms of what happens if there is another wave. But from a pure transition to e-commerce, just shopping online, yes, that volume is picked up. Now, will that continue beyond December? I have no idea.
It'll be interesting to see what happens. Let's put it that way. Well, I think we're unfortunately getting to the end of our time here. This has been a really fascinating conversation. And I think Kelsey has one more question. But before we do that, how can people learn more about you and Theorem?
Go to our website. Go to theoreminc.net. You can do a search. We are up there on Google. We have case studies. We have thought leadership, logs. We have company culture. It's one of our most visited, it's one of the top three most visited sections of the website, believe it or not. So we're very proud of that. So check us out.
Great. Excellent.
Well, I have to ask, what advice would you give to those that are CMOs or aspiring to be one based on, you know, the future trends we're seeing today and preparing for the future?
Don't let technology or tools or some of those tactical pieces you read distract you from that original goal of marketing, which is experience, education, know your customer, know your audience. Goes back to what we were talking about earlier, where there is a lot of noise with all of the technologies, but at the end of the day, marketing is fairly human and very old-fashioned, which is, you know, treat me like a human. Yep. And everything else falls into place.
Keep the foundations of marketing, marketing.
Yeah, thank you.
Oh, awesome. Thank you so much for your time today, Jay. This was a great conversation. Make sure to follow the Next CMO and Plana on Twitter and LinkedIn. And if you have any ideas for topics or guests, you can email us at thenextcmo@plana.com. Have a great day, everyone.
Thank you.
Bye.